Hey, MWI Podcast listeners, before we get to this episode, I've got some exciting news about a really interesting opportunity. If you follow MWI, you're almost certainly familiar with the Harding Project. Well, the Harding Fellowship prepares Army leaders to drive professional discussion. Harding Fellows earn a graduate degree and then edit their branch journals, helping to shape the ideas that shape the Army. So if you know a sharp officer, senior NCO, or warrant officer who might be interested, please tell them that they can learn all about this opportunity at www.lineofdeparture.army.mil/Harding.
European security is not just driven by the traditional states that you would have expected from a sort of 90s view of European security. It's the smaller states that you need to look at to get that real sense of urgency. You get political unity, you get policy unity, but actually one of the bits where you have most fragmentation is defence industry, defence industrial production within Europe. It's not just the traditional heavy metal sort of tanks, frigates, etc. A lot of this is also about software. Keeping troops at high readiness is also very, very expensive, which again, European nations are finding out.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI Podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point Class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and on this episode, we're examining the European defense and security landscape. Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 galvanized both NATO and the European Union. But how has political and strategic unity translated to improvements of collective defense and deterrence? Which European states are leading the way? And after 3.5 years of war, just how much has the European security landscape changed? To explore those questions, I'm joined for an insightful discussion by Ed Arnold, a senior research fellow for European security at the Royal United Services Institute. Before we get to it, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point Class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Ed Arnold. Ed, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So you are a senior research fellow for European security at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute. And that's what I asked you to come on the podcast to talk about today, the European security landscape. When we talk about that landscape, there are certain features that are sort of static fixtures. An alliance, for instance, NATO, that has been around for 76 years now. But there are also elements of dynamism to that landscape. We've really seen that in the past decade or so with Russian aggression toward Ukraine, beginning in 2014. As one example, but especially, the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022. That was a major inflection point, of course, but, it's not the only inflection point or the only driver of change in European security. So, if we really look at that sort of recent period, a decade or so, what are some of the elements that have been the biggest contributors to changes in the European security landscape?
Yeah, I think you're right. And the interesting thing about working on European security is quite often, when we're talking about issues surrounding NATO at the moment, you're going back and reading a document that was signed in 1949, that had a couple of revisions on some of the minor articles. But, the big articles, Article 3, 4, 5, that wording is exactly the same. So there is a permanence. But the sort of as the security environments change, sort of the interpretation of those words changes as well. And, I agree with the assessment that there's some sort of permanence within that. But I think the issue with the crisis in European security now is some of those real foundational pillars of European security are being questioned. And really in the last decade, it has been the Russian aggression towards Europe, principally in Ukraine, which started off with Crimea and the incursions into Donbass in 2014, but a whole host of other Russian hybrid nefarious activities, you know, poisoning within Salisbury in the UK, you know, the deployment of chemical weapons on UK soil by Russia, which is increasingly outlandish. And there were a lot of countries that sort of, they did start to wake up and they did start to change. But actually for the whole organization to change and some of those big players, you know, principally Germany as an example, it took the full-scale invasion, not just the full-scale invasion, but the brutality of it all to actually drive that change and, you know, change in behaviors amongst politicians and policymakers. And we're still living through that transition at the moment.
You know, I don't think it's controversial to say that there's some uncertainty on the part of Europeans about the U.S. commitment to European security. But I also think it's important to understand that in a broader context of a very dynamic security environment over the past number of years, how do you sort of position, you know, I guess this current moment in that context?
Yeah, and I think the issue is, I mean, we all say that the driver for all of this change was the crisis in European security brought about by the full-scale invasion in 2022. But actually, I think you need to sort of break it down. And I sort of certainly see phase one of that between 2014, the annex of Crimea, and the Russian invasion. But actually, since the Russian invasion, I think, you know, phase two was certainly the first 3 years of that, up until the election of Donald Trump for his second term. And the issue there was Russia was the enemy. It was the galvanizing force. And that actually brought all of the Europeans together, plus the US as well, showing real leadership on not just support to Ukraine, but also enhancing defense and deterrence in Europe. So it brought everyone together. We're now in sort of phase three, which is sort of started off by the second Trump presidency, because the primary source of instability for European states is the commander-in-chief of the preeminent military force within the alliance. And that is what's causing real frictions. And actually, you then start to, you know, that unity begins to fray and things start to separate out. So while NATO, you know, is the principal organization for defense and deterrence, the EU is far more important in terms of the financial instruments, both in terms of sanctions, but also making the cash available for Europe's rearmament. But what you're seeing is actually a lot of activity driven by unilateral formats, both political and military, as sort of European security starts to fragment. I think that's the position we're absolutely in right now, that whereas in that first phase, you know, NATO's response to everything, it was very measured. You have to gain consensus. You have to go at the speed of the slowest member. A lot of nations are just saying, no, not anymore. We're getting ready to fight. And we don't really care about having the negotiations around the table in NATO. So I would say that the preeminent military forces within NATO at the moment, so, you know, US, UK, France, Poland, the Finns, primary examples, their defense planning process and their whole defense outlook is actually geared to Article 3, which is self-help, self-defense. Not Article 5, whereas a lot of the other smaller nations are basically organized for Article 5, as in everyone will join on my behalf. So I think that's sort of an interesting change now, that certainly in the last, I'd say, 6 to 8 months, some countries are just moving far ahead and they don't really mind at the sort of the slow pace of some members. And the UK within that, I mean, it is a real opportunity for the UK to lead on defence and security. And in certain areas, the UK absolutely has. But there's still this sort of slight cloud hanging over the UK in terms of European security, because the level of ambition in terms of policy, what we talk about, just does not currently match the scale of resources that we have to achieve those tasks.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, this emergence of bilateral relationships, minilateral blocks that are influential and making progress. But, you know, I guess, does it pose any sort of risk to NATO cohesion when initiative and progress are coming out of these smaller groupings where, you know, it might have previously happened through formal NATO channels?
I mean, it does pose a risk, but I think that they, you know, that activity within those are not mutually exclusive. And they can actually strengthen NATO in the sense is that you get those stronger states aligning and sort of gathering consensus amongst themselves and then bringing others on board. I mean, it has to be done very diplomatically, just in terms of alliance politics. But I actually see it as a real benefit and actually something that NATO really needs to embrace, because while NATO might want to do the sort of what they call the 360 degree approach to security, which was agreed at the Warsaw Summit in 2016, which is both geographically, so able to do the whole of the Euro-Atlantic area, and all allies should be able to fit into that, and also thematically, so in terms of defense and deterrence, cyber, etc. But even an alliance as mighty as NATO, that is quite a lot to do. And actually, I think it's the US, not just participation, but active participation in the alliance, which allows NATO to actually have that as an ambition. If you start to take that away and start to see that the US are going to be engaged elsewhere, then they can't really assure that approach. So what Europe would probably have to do is actually break down regionally. You know, there's a lot of difference between fighting in the Arctic and potentially fighting in the Mediterranean. You need different kit and equipment. You need, you know, different everything, quite frankly. So actually where NATO now is that it's got its three regional plans, and I sort of say this to Europeans, that, well, if the US does significantly draw down, and we're not really seeing those indications yet, and actually we're seeing the opposite in some areas such as the Arctic and the High North, you say, well, yeah, you know, it's a big issue for Europe to contend with less US support if you look at it as the whole of the Euro-Atlantic area. If you're looking at it at a regional level and you have regional groupings, you know, such as the UK, I mean, the UK leads in the north through the Joint Expeditionary Force and bilaterals and minilaterals. It's very good ground in terms of where UK key defence capabilities are. So if you break it down actually into the regional level, it's far more manageable for the Europeans to do if they move to what I call sort of hyper-specialization, something, a term that's been around from Europe for a long time, and there's been, you know, advances in some areas, but quite poor in others. And I think just the security environment now with a threat from Russia and an uncertain US, that is probably the only model that the Europeans will be able to do if they want to keep NATO together in as close to its current form as possible.
Hyper-specialization in what sense?
So, you know, as an example, I mean, you know, let's take the Arctic. I mean, fighting in the Arctic, it's not just a case of giving skis and a rifle to a soldier. You know, you have to have deep specialization in those areas which the Arctic nations have. You know, all of your equipment needs to be cold weather equipment. But in terms of the sort of 360 degree approach, in theory, you know, the Portuguese might need to go up to the Arctic. And, you know, there have been examples previously where NATO, Joint Force Command Naples, have sent sort of Italian soldiers, not even the Arctic troops, in terms of mountain warfare specialists, up to the Arctic kind of to give that political demonstration that, you know, the southern states support the northern states and vice versa, which sort of meets a political logic, not a military logic. So I think in terms of hyper-specialization and the regional plans, which are an extrapolation of national defense plans, saying, you know, you have this area, you have this geography, you need to build kit and equipment that fits into that plan. You're not going to be in all areas at all times. And I think for a lot of nations, that's really encouraging. So take Poland. I mean, Poland has traditionally not done that many expeditionary operations because they're worried about the Russian threat. They do territorial defense and they do heavy territorial defense. Whereas the UK, as an example, you know, still talking about being a global power, not just in terms of the Indo-Pacific and Europe, but even within Europe. I think that, you know, the message to the UK would be like, you know, no, you focus in the High North. You know, you don't do the Black Sea. Even though you might want to do that as well, you know, you don't do Mediterranean, you know, that's for others to do, and actually build a division of labor that way where regional leaders, regional specialization can occur. And I think you're already, again, seeing this in the north now with all of the Nordic nations now united in NATO. It's a fundamental change to the political and political geography and actual geography within Europe. And it's an area also whereby the Russians, because of the way that the war in Ukraine's gone, means that they're just far weaker than they were in the north, and they're trying to address that now. So the moment now is to act to get that overmatch in certain particular areas, especially the north, so that you can continue deterrence into the future, even as the Russians recapitalize.
How new is that hyper-specialization, though, conceptually? Because, you know, NATO has always been characterized by some pretty stark discrepancies between, I'd say, you know, the strategic perspectives of members based on where they sit geographically in Europe, but also in terms of, you know, in terms of the capabilities of some of its largest members versus those of smaller members. It's an alliance made up of a lot of member states, and, you know, there's going to be some diversity. I think NATO has actually historically done some things that are quite clever in terms of doctrine, for example, especially during the Cold War with the development of NATO concepts that complemented U.S. operational concepts. But it's also done some things, you know, in terms of organizational infrastructure and in other areas to sort of ensure that all members can contribute in ways that I guess acknowledge that diversity, if that makes sense. So is this hyper-specialization that you're describing, you know, is it a new thing, or is it more of sort of maybe the next manifestation of what NATO has always had to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a, you know, it is, there's an element of Cold War Renaissance, but obviously brought up to 21st century sort of, you know, industrial war fighting that we're currently seeing. But the issue, if you look at it specifically from NATO perspective and that hyper-specialization, what is now the big change with NATO's new military strategy and these regional plans is that, you know, the frontline states know exactly where they're going to fight because they're fighting on home turf. The states that are contributing to forward land forces in, you know, the nine that now span all of the eastern NATO states, they know where they're going to fight, and they also know where they're going to reinforce. So that means that you can actually move far deeper down the specialization stack because you know exactly the ground that you're going to fight in and the likely circumstances. At the end of the Cold War and really up until probably 2019, when NATO was sort of moving towards that structure, and then quicker after 2022, the issue was, you know, we were configured for expeditionary warfare. We didn't know exactly where that potentially might be. So, for example, in Europe, I mean, the Czech military were always very, very good at CBRN capabilities, you know, and they specialized. And they, you know, the theory was, well, if they're specialized in that, no, you know, the other countries don't need to take it as seriously because you've got a domain-specific specialization. But then, you know, that all falls apart when the political decision of the Czech government of the day says, well, actually, no, we're not going to deploy to South Sudan, wherever it might be. And that's where the specialization part fell apart. The political unity that you now get with NATO and sort of the acknowledgement and the new political declarations coming out of NATO to defend every inch of NATO territory, that sort of problem doesn't, it's mitigated, it doesn't fully go away because, you know, national governments still decide. But I think there's more of a groundswell of not just political but also public opinion that NATO is really now committed to those frontline states. So again, that allows you that flexibility of saying, no, actually we need to go for the capabilities that match what is given to us within these regional plans. So SACA can then fight that sort of battle in front of them in the easiest way possible.
You know, you've spoken about unity and, you know, February 2022 and the Russian invasion, this was clearly a galvanizing moment. Is that unity still as high as it was then? Is Europe still galvanized, or has, you know, I guess has a degree of fatigue set in after what's approaching 3.5 years of this war?
Yeah, I mean, this is the issue with the, you know, the unity that was provided principally by the Russians, quite frankly. Yeah, it has frayed in certain areas, but also, I know there is fatigue in some, but also states are also re-energized by certain situations. And I think for, especially on Europe, I mean, that re-energization has happened through, again, the Trump administration and some of the comments by key members of the administration directly pushed at the Europeans. You know, so for example, at the start of the year, Secretary Hegseth's remarks to the Ukraine Defense Contact Group. I mean, if you read that alongside Robert Gates's 2011 speech on the future of NATO, I mean, the language is a bit more coarse, but it's effectively the same message. You need to do more for your defense. So I think, you know, taking Germany, and it's a really good example. I mean, the shock of the war in Ukraine had a profound impact on the then chancellor and also the country. I mean, his sort of Zeitenwende speech, his turning point speech, the announcement of this 100 billion special fund happened on a Sunday in a Bundestag. You know, that doesn't really happen, you know, within 3 days, complete sea change. But I think, you know, Germany especially realized that just spending more money on defense does not then make you a defense and security actor. And, you know, to be very fair to that government, you know, it required changes to the constitution, the basic law, all very politically contentious in Germany anyway. And then also you're talking about sort of defense and security, but they really sort of grew into the role. But then there was a bit of a, you know, it stalled a bit, and it was also unbalanced. So yes, they achieved a turning point in terms of energy security and reliance on Russian oil, but was it a full one? And now with the new government in place, led by Chancellor Merz, you're seeing that re-energization of making sure that, you know, and some of the things that they're talking about now, you know, long-range strike capabilities to Ukraine, a lot of money into Ukrainian defense industry so they can self-produce long-range strike capabilities. These are very, very live conversations at the moment. So I think in certain countries, they've had that initial jolt. And then especially this year, they're doing a lot more. And if you look at defense spending, a lot of other nations, mainly Northern European nations, you know, Sweden as an example, they're not waiting for the NATO summit in a couple of weeks' time for a new defense investment pledge, which kind of looks like around 3.5% maybe on defense and then a further 1.5% on infrastructure. They're just going for it. And actually what you're seeing is the smaller nations are doing it as well. And also in terms of increasing support to Ukraine. So, you know, yeah, we always focus on the UK, France and Germany as the traditional countries, and particularly Poland as rising as defense and security actor. But I always say, so look at the Netherlands, look at the Danes, what they are now spending on defense and what they have and are planning to provide to Ukraine, you know, F-16s, etc. That started with both of those two nations. The Danes, fairly early on in the war, actually donated all of their self-propelled artillery. And it's not old stuff that they wanted to get rid of to buy new stuff either. It's the Caesar system, which is one of the best performing howitzers in Ukraine. So again, European security is not just driven by the traditional states that you would have expected from a sort of 90s view of European security. It's the smaller states that you need to look at to get that real sense of urgency in Europe.
I do want to dig deeper into, I guess, the question of which countries are stepping up and leading as defense and security actors, and also what that actually means, you know, what leadership looks like. But, you know, maybe, you know, is that an outdated concept, thinking in terms of what country is leading Europe?
Yeah, I mean, this is the difficulty. And I think, you know, the oversized influence that the US has played in Europe means that no one nation can replace that or even really, really mitigate it. It's got to be a group. And as I said earlier, in terms of these sort of smaller coalitions of the willing sort of unilateral frameworks, I think they are very valuable. There's just also too many of them. And you see this sort of what we call shuttle diplomacy, where defense ministers, foreign ministers, etc., like they're running all over Europe, creating all of these new groupings, you know, having these sort of mini, what's referred to as sort of mini summits. They're all talking about the same thing. And I think the Weimar Plus, which seems to, is the sort of what it's being described as, but that is the UK, France, Germany, and Poland. That does seem to be probably the best one to push forward, because principled defense and security actors, but also it's bridging the, you know, UK, EU, NATO divide, etc. And, you know, I'm a strong believer in that format, that if you gain alignment on that from in terms of Europe, it's a very well-balanced grouping as well. You know, because though, for example, the Baltic states aren't within that, I mean, Poland speaks for the Baltic states, quite frankly, because they're in their AO and they see the Russian threat in a very similar way. And yeah, so if you're trying to get agreements as a group of four and then sort of push that out to other members to gain agreements, that is actually a very good way of pressing ahead and showing that leadership that's required. And then there's other states, again, you know, let's say Finland. I mean, they're showing real leadership in the sense that they're just really serious about readiness. You know, if you look at their military forces, their comprehensive security system, the way that they can switch from civilian to military production very, very quickly, the way that they deal with hybrid threats, you know, really significant. So you've seen all of these cable cutting and damage incidents in the Baltic over the last few years, kind of a phenomenon that actually started just before 2022 and has obviously escalated. But up until the Finns decided to board the Lioness at the end of last year, you know, very clear legal framework, we're going to board. And then that sort of set the tone. So then, you know, the Swedes have also boarded a vessel, which enhances deterrence, because up until that point, you know, the Russians and a variety of other nefarious actors, you know, the Chinese as well moving in, they were like, well, we can kind of do this because they're not going to board. And then they did. So again, it's sort of, you know, leadership is a very sort of complex thing within Europe. But again, I would say that it's not just those larger states. Again, support to Ukraine, a lot of the nations that are doing that are, you know, what you'd consider the smaller nations, you know, Sweden, Norway, Finland, the Baltic states, Nordic, Netherlands, Denmark, again, really pushing through is quite, you know, important interventions, both in the war in Ukraine, but also wider European security.
It's easy to look at official photos released after multilateral meetings, after formal summits, and, you know, it's all of these heads of government or key leaders from various countries standing shoulder to shoulder. You see these photos and they project unity. But the reality is, you know, there are challenges to that unity. Finnish and Swedish accession to NATO had to navigate the challenge of Turkish resistance to that accession. Obviously, there are some concerns about Hungary under Viktor Orban. How are those issues being dealt with? You know, are they just ignored sometimes? Maybe not ignored, but, you know, sort of deprioritized because putting together an aid package for Ukraine is more important in the moment, for example. Or, you know, if the UK, Germany, France, and Poland get together and they want to do something together, are they, you know, are they discussing, hey, how are we going to get Orban on board?
They are, and it's a broader issue, not just in terms of defense and security. And I think, you know, taking the Hungary example, just the way that the EU instruments work, Hungary is a far more difficult blocker in the EU than it is in terms of NATO. And I think, yeah, I mean, absolutely right about Turkey. But I think, you know, in the specific example of Turkey holding up Finnish for a bit and then Swedish accession, they also wanted certain things. You know, they wanted to get things behind closed doors, which I think they're broadly successful in. I mean, it's very difficult to see what Viktor Orban particularly wants in terms of Hungary's position, both in NATO and in the EU, apart from just to be quite awkward. But I think it's really important because, you know, within Europe, I mean, there is a rise of populist parties, both on the right and both on the left, that are doing very, very well in also, you know, traditional countries. I mean, the AfD in Germany, which is, you know, the domestic security services have labeled it extremist, you know, which is remarkable in itself. You know, they came second in the federal election. You know, in France now, in the latest few rounds of presidential elections, it's kind of a centrist candidate versus far right candidate. You know, and even in the UK, I mean, Reform on the right again are polling higher than the government, and certainly higher in terms of the traditional opposition, in terms of Conservative Party. So my position has always been, you know, the difficult people in the organizations might be Turkey and Hungary today, but tomorrow it's Slovakia, you know, another state. And it could be, you know, within a few years, some of the larger states. And that's quite difficult to manage as an alliance. And I think you really need to hit that head on. And at the moment, for example, in the EU, because sanctions on Russia need to basically be voted on a rolling basis, they're almost coming up with national sanctions policies for 26 members to implement nationally if the Hungarians decide to block unanimity at 27, which... You know, it's not a great workaround, and also it's a lot of effort in terms of policymakers in all of those countries doing that independently rather than at an EU level, which just generally sucks up a lot of capacity. So this is it. I think you need to look at polling in each of these countries. You need to look further ahead, and you need to realise, well, actually this, you know, that's what might fray political, that's what's likely to fray the unity within European security. It's from national governments who are either moving right or left in more extremes, or the centrist parties are having to move towards the extremes in order to combat the attacks from those parties. And you know, this is what I say about European security, that you know, we look at you know, a large geographical area of the globe that covers European security, a lot of states within that. It's all about domestic politics in the end. So a real, very good understanding of domestic politics in these other countries is very useful for analysis on where the trends might go.
And I think it's worth remembering that, you know, this has always been the case to some degree, and that NATO has never been, you know, composed exclusively of liberal democracies with governments clustered kind of in the same narrow part of the ideological spectrum. What about China? You know, if we shift gears, what role does China play when we take a 30,000 foot view of European security?
Yeah, so I think it's, you know, it's really, first and foremost, it's about sort of where the US is looking. And again, I think, you know, Secretary Hegseth's remarks in January were refreshing from being a European, because, you know, it was, you know, we are deprioritizing Europe because we have other priorities within the Indo-Pacific. Very interesting that he said specifically the challenge of China in the Indo-Pacific. He didn't talk about sort of competing with China in Africa, in the Arctic. It was very much a sort of geographical delineation with the Indo-Pacific. And I think for the Europeans, this is sort of the difficulty, because in terms of those signals that were coming from the Biden administration and the Trump administration, they still need a bit more clarity, because it's not quite as clear cut as, well, you deal with Europe and Russia, we're going to deal with China in the Indo-Pacific. That's sort of the implicit division of labor, but also the, you know, the US do want far more support within the Indo-Pacific as well, which kind of the problem is, it pulls Europe in two ways, because to have a military effect in the Indo-Pacific, you need expeditionary capabilities, which not many European nations do. As Europeans are moving away from expeditionary warfare, which has not gone well for them in Iraq, Afghanistan, Sahel, Libya, are moving back towards defense and deterrence. And I think sort of where the US position has been for a while now is kind of they want that increased diplomatic support within the Indo-Pacific, certainly, but probably not as much military support as we probably think they need. Because ultimately, I mean, you know, the US is focusing on China. You know, what addition would a, you know, valuable would a carrier strike group from the UK be to, you know, the massive potential US war machine? And also, you know, big risk on the UK side that, you know, if you put a carrier strike group in the Indo-Pacific and it moves to a shooting war with China, I mean, you might lose it in an afternoon, and then you've got no carrier strike capability and a lot of these sort of support vessels gone as well. So I think that's what needs to be really understood now with the way that the Trump administration's going, and hopefully there'll be more out of the sort of the National Defense Review that's happening in the US of exactly what military support the US expects from Europeans in the Indo-Pacific. I think the previous Secretary General of NATO was pretty clear on this as well. You know, it's not that NATO, you know, in some discussions, you're moving towards China and the Indo-Pacific. It's the fact that China's coming in to Europe. That's why we need to take it more seriously. And the communique last year at the Washington summit was far more explicit language in terms of China. You know, it called China out as a decisive enabler of Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine, and, you know, called on China to sort of cease and desist that activity. So I think it's something that, you know, we'll see more of in terms of discussions at the summit in a couple of weeks. But it's something that the Europeans are far more comfortable talking about now than they were perhaps 3 or 4 years ago.
So zooming out beyond solely NATO, you mentioned earlier the key role that the European Union plays in some of the political issues, sanctions, implementation, and things of that nature. How well are NATO and the EU working together at this stage, particularly with respect to Russia, but also on defense issues broadly? Are there any specific frictions there?
Yeah, there's frictions, and I think what's interesting about those potential frictions is they can be quite personality driven, considering who's at the top of the sort of the NATO leadership and EU leadership at similar times, bearing in mind that they're both headquartered in Brussels and it's sort of a quite insular sort of political community there. And that has affected in the last couple of years. But I think actually, you know, when I started doing European security, you know, the discussions were always quite, you know, is this NATO, is it EU? They revolved, you know, there were never really any answers to it. What has happened now is sort of with the invasion, the Russian invasion in 2022, that sort of has created or sort of transformed the security environment so much. It's actually delineated what NATO and the EU are for. You know, the EU is saying, you know, we do not do defense and deterrence, despite the fact that we have a mutual defense clause, which is actually stronger than NATO Article 5 when you read it, 42.7. You know, we don't do territorial defense. And, you know, if they did and people did think that that mechanism was as strong as some people within the EU wanted, I mean, Finland and Sweden wouldn't have thought to join NATO. So it's now NATO does defense and deterrence. You know, we know that its command structure can deal with that. It's a nuclear alliance. Great. For the EU, the difficulty is they were wanting to sort of more specialize in crisis management operations, but I think a lot of European capitals just lost the political appetite to do that in this security environment. What the EU can do very well is make the funds available to spend on defense, and they're really pushing hard with that. The problem is, you know, that's in some ways the easy part, you know, raising the funds. It's what you spend it on. So the key part now is aligning NATO standardization and also modernization in terms of how NATO wants to fight a potential future war with Russia. You know, as an example, you know, long range strike that Ukraine are using, you know, the Russians are really vulnerable to it. So NATO wants to do more long range strike. So if you get standardization out of the area, and then you can funnel the funds that have been created through EU financial mechanisms, then that is a way that you can capitalize in certain equipment that is going to probably be what you require for a potential future war with Russia. And that's the key point at the moment, which broadly speaking, the Europeans do not have a very good track record on working out what to buy. There's a lot of duplication within the system. There's a lot of disagreements within. I mean, you know, when you talked earlier about unity, I think, you know, you get political unity, you get policy unity, but actually one of the bits where you have most fragmentation is defense industry, defense industrial production within Europe. In some areas, it's improving significantly. In some areas, it's really lagging behind. And that's, again, what the EU probably more sits in their lane, you know, trying to work out how they can ramp up defense industrial capacity to the extent that they can not just re-equip our own forces, but again, sustain Ukraine in the future to make sure that they're able to fight, not just, for example, this summer, but also for renewed Russian offensives in the future if no ceasefire is agreed.
It's a challenge, particularly given the fact that European countries you know, have their own defense industrial bases, right? You have defense firms in various countries that are competing with one another, and you have political leaders in capital cities that aren't unbiased in that competition. They want to see their defense firm successful, quite naturally. How much risk is there then that, you know, you can have this sense of unity and agreement about broad, shared political objectives like supporting Ukraine, like strengthening European defense broadly, but because of private sector dynamics, you end up maybe going about it in a really inefficient way.
Yeah, and I think the issue is, I mean, you have to expect some level of inefficiency. It's just, you know, to try and get through some of those major blockers. Like I say, you know, there's some areas where it's, you know, very positive, some areas like annoyingly frustrating. But also I think sort of defense industry is changing as well. I mean, what the Europeans are required to buy, it's not just, you know, the traditional heavy metal sort of tanks, frigates, etc. A lot of this is also about software enabled, and also the, you know, European nations realizing that actually you don't want lots of high-end kit because it's just not survivable on a modern battlefield. So as an example, I mean, you know, at the start of the war in Ukraine, and I mean, you know, German defense industry, you know, very good exporters and very high-end kit. But actually a lot of the data coming back from Ukraine saying it's just, it's over-engineered and it's really difficult to actually keep in the fight. So, you know, German defense industry has to really quite quickly acknowledge that and move to more simple systems that also can be cross-decked between nations, etc. So, you know, another good example is new submarines between Germany and Norway that both nations will operate. They're identical. There's no specialist requirements from either side. So that means you can get them in quicker. And also, again, you have a platform that can potentially be cross-decked. Very useful as well in terms of armored vehicles if you're doing that, because the key problem, not just, you know, the US has this as well, but I think the key problem in Europe with all of this is, you know, Poland can have the, you know, buy 1,000 K2 Panther tanks from South Korea. Does it have the drivers and the gunners that can actually get in those tanks and train efficiently and get to that readiness? No, because I mean, you know, Poland, I mean, it's looking to improve with, you know, various conscription models and also just, you know, generally in terms of resilience models increase. But that is one of the major issues. You know, the UK are, you know, headcount at the moment in terms of where the British Army wants to be is 72,500. But if you actually look at available strength, it's 55,000, you know, due to injury and other issues that keep sort of soldiers from being deployed. But that is actually probably one of the greatest weaknesses in the British system. Not necessarily, I mean, it is as well, but in terms of those capabilities, and European nations are all finding this now. You know, even, you know, just over, I think it was this weekend, I saw a story that sort of what's, you know, there's a political decision to be made in Germany moving back from conscription. You know, they luckily what, you know, they still have a that institutional memory of when conscription still existed, because they didn't get they didn't do away with that system too long ago. But because of GDPR rules and keeping data, a lot of those people who would have latent military training that just needs to basically be brought up to speed and therefore you could scale very quickly, they don't have the data because they had to delete it because of GDPR rules. So again, there's these real challenges within Europe around policies. Again, in the UK, one of the real issues at the moment is a policy of actually just operating drones within UK airspace. Prevent the military training on them at the level that are required. You know, I've got a former colleague from my army days who's now a company commander, and he's on Salisbury Plain exercising for 6 weeks now, and he has a handful of drones at a company level available to him. When in Ukraine, I mean, you know, down at a section squad level, they'd have more than, you know, companies training with as well. So it's these things that are procedural that are actually preventing a lot of European militaries getting up to speed on these technologies quickly.
So if we zoom out and look at Europe collectively, and by that I mean both NATO and the EU, if we look at Europe trying to build its defense capacity, is there like a target on the wall? Is this principally rooted in the here and now of Russian aggression in Ukraine and you know, kind of in the short term, you know, a year or 2 years out? Or is it, you know, maybe even informally, is there a sense that there's a time frame that kind of underscores all of this work that looks farther out to 2030, 2040, or beyond?
Well, yeah, this is the really difficult thing. So, I mean, NATO has Allied Command Operations, so SHAPE, etc., but it also has Allied Command Transformation, which is sort of looking to a decade ahead, the warfighting capstone concept. And that sort of worked in a state of sort of pre-2022. The issue is that gap between ACO and ACT has narrowed significantly. And, you know, NATO has been good. It was mainly after the Washington summit last year where they're creating far more mechanisms for sharing data with Ukraine, who are effectively fighting in contact against the probable enemy, which is providing a lot of data for. But it's difficult because, you know, tactical adaption cycles on the battlefield at the moment is sort of 6 to 8 weeks. And also, you know, the Ukrainians, especially fairly recently, have said that actually a lot of the drones that are supplied by US companies, by European companies, that they don't use them anymore because they basically are completely defeated by Russian EW capabilities. So I think that the real key for NATO now is to use that data from Ukraine and sort of a little bit of a leap of faith. What I think would be very dangerous is overanalyzing the situation in Ukraine, because it's going to be different. But ultimately, you know, almost across the board, with the exception of a couple of European countries, the situation is so dire militarily that it kind of, for me personally, you know, very personal view here, it doesn't matter too much about the capabilities, the doctrine, etc., because you've got to be ready to fight. You know, you need the personnel on the books. You need them with a basic level of military training. You need the equipment. And this is one of the problems, that prior to thinking that we'd be doing, you know, industrial interstate warfare, a lot of European nations, I mean, their high-end forces are ready. You know, so UK high readiness forces, including special forces, the tip of the spear is very, very sharp. The rest of it isn't. And, you know, same in, you know, in Germany, and, you know, this is the same, you know, militaries always do this, but effectively to keep those high readiness forces, you cannibalize the kit. So basically it's, you've actually only got a couple of squadrons of tanks ready, and you just rotate the people as they rotate onto the high readiness part. And, you know, keeping troops at high readiness is also very, very expensive, which, again, European nations are finding out. And I think that's the bigger challenge. So I worry that we're more concerned about exactly how we're going to fight, exactly how the Russians might fight in a certain time frame, you know, 3, 5, 7 years. It sort of varies between nations. But my point is, in the short term, I don't think that matters as much as just getting to the levels of readiness that are required. That is probably the bigger challenge.
Well, to sort of close out the discussion, I'm going to ask what I guess is, you know, admittedly kind of an impossible question. We've talked about a lot of dynamics that are at play, and these dynamics are complex. They're interactive. But if we sort of try to bring it all together, and if you had to summarize where things stand now, you know, as we approach the middle of 2025, how do you kind of sum up the state of play of the European defense and security landscape?
Well, I think the issue is the NATO summit in The Hague, which is in around 3 weeks' time. I mean, that's going to be decisive for Euro-Atlantic unity, and also an opportunity for the US to set exactly how it's going to approach European security in the future, and also set a NATO spending target. And I think a lot of where the future might lie for European security is actually what happens at that summit and how seriously the Europeans take that. You know, there is a significant opportunity here for the Europeans as well. you spend the money, spend it wisely while the Russians are still fighting within Ukraine and being reduced, you know, on a daily basis. And that's how you effectively get your defense and deterrence pitch for the future. So it's really an opportune moment that the Europeans absolutely can't waste.
Well, Ed, I think we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you again for taking time to join me for this discussion on the MWI podcast. It's a fascinating subject. It's a complicated subject, but it's fundamentally an important subject. So I appreciate you sharing your insights.
No worries. And thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.